Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 132, The Mysterious and the Communal, Part 4. Again, reading from God is Red by Vine Deloria Jr., published by Fulcrum. And here's a quote off of Wikipedia. From Vine Deloria Jr., religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for those who've already been there. Some of the many books he's written, starting off in the 70s, 60s, Custer Died for Your Sins, an Indian Manifesto. Aggressions of Civilization, Federal Indian Policy Since the 1880s. Beyond the Trail of Broken Treaties, an Indian Declaration of Independence. Red Earth, White Lies, Native Americans and the Myth of Scientific Fact. The Red Man in the New World Drama, a politico-legal study with a pageantry of American Indian history. And on, many of his books to check out. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Chapter 9, starting off here, Natural and Hybrid Peoples. In 1972, when I began this book, I excluded some questions that were integral to examination of the idea of land and religion. The most basic question, of course, is how we can conceive of deity at all if our religious experiences and knowledge derive primarily from the environment around us. What messages do we invoke, and what can we expect in the way of relationship with him, her, or them? As in caps. I did not anticipate that the complexity of the subject might require considerable critical examination of the cultural context in which religions and ideas about deities appear. During the past two decades, I have been able to discover a set of lesser questions that, when taken as a unified inquiry, have led me into a better understanding of how to deal with the major question of the validity and viability of religion. Still, in order to ask the proper questions, one must believe that reality is a bit different from what we have been taught to believe, and in this respect, I owe it all, in the last analysis, to Oral Roberts. Several years back, in a memorable TV performance, Oral said that God was dissatisfied with Oral's ministry and had threatened that if he did not raise something like $10 million by a certain date, God would, quote, call him home, end quote. Since the reward for faithful service for most Christians, if we take funeral orations seriously, is to be called home, it struck me as mighty strange that Oral was resisting this option with all his might. On reflection, it also seems strange that after some 2,000 years of bribing his followers to be good with promises of eternal life, the deity had resorted to extortion as a means of keeping people in line. A few weeks later, when I happened to be reading one of the Old Testament prophets, it suddenly occurred to me that the Judeo-Christian deity had been a pretty rough character all along. He was always throwing fits of anger over some real or imagined slight. He monitored every activity of his chosen people to see that they were obeying some rather vague instructions he had given them, and to hear some Protestants tell it, he had a large ledger book in which he recorded all our evil thoughts and deeds. This behavior can be described in a humorous way, but it is not very funny. It suggests a deity very closed modeled, not only after a human personality, but also after a personality that is unbalanced and immature. The Judeo-Christian deity, as a matter of fact, has emotional characteristics that are quite common and can be easily identified in contemporary human beings. He has the egotism of Henry Kissinger, the stability of Donald Trump, the generosity of Edwin Meese, and the military mind of George Bush. We should remember that Yahweh killed some 185,000 Arabs in Sennacherib's army outside Jerusalem one night. Bush slaughtered almost as many in the prolonged bombing of Iraq during the winter of 1991. Both seem to have had the same motive. The Arabs had disregarded one of their warnings. Having a, quote, personal relationship with this deity is akin to being J. Edgar Hoover's best friend. It is safe, but not satisfying. If people are offended by these comparisons, it is because they have not read their Bible objectively to see how their deity has behaved historically. In Western society, we are taught that the deity is benign, friendly, and intent upon making us rich. So we can read Bible verses that command genocidal acts and pretend that they are merely divine bombast designed to scare us into behaving. When we step outside this cultural context and try to understand the Bible as a literal historical document, we discover that the portrait of the deity sketched in the Old Testament is very negative and in fact may describe a psychopath. Like Saddam Hussein, if he is indeed what our media says he is. We find the image of a despotic Oriental monarch determined to have the way regardless of how it affects his subjects. This uncomfortable image has been further illuminated for me by the startling contrast between Near Eastern religions on the one hand and other world and tribal religions on the other. Near Eastern deities seem to thrive on controlling all human historical and political situations. They disregard natural law, unable to direct the activities of the physical world in a manner that would enlighten its inhabitants, and are intent on devising punishments. If there is any evidence of a karmic balancing process here, it is submerged under pictures of burning hells and blissful heavens. They are obsessed with human sexual activities and genetic purity. They demand blood sacrifices of birds, animals, and sometimes human beings as the only acceptable way of forgiving our transgressions. Such abstract concepts as redemption and atonement dominate their conversations with humans. The intellectual devotional structure of the Near Eastern religions consists of these legalities and is presented in sophisticated arguments better raised in a courtroom than in the world as we know it. Their solution to many problems is simply to destroy the world and start over. That reminds me of the U.S. Empire, you know, going into Iraq and destroying the antiquities and basically destroying so they can rebuild the green zone, etc., etc. One more paragraph here on this bit. Only by drawing out the most realistic portrait of a deity can we begin to understand what the image really means. So let us subject the tribal conceptions of deity and religion in the same critique and scrutiny. These are serious questions, whether Indian tribes actually had any conception of religion or of a deity at all. Wherever we find Indians and wherever we inquire about their idea of God, they tell us that beneath the surface of the physical universe is a mysterious spiritual power which cannot be described in human images that must remain always the great mystery. So a couple of comments there. That's for a while, hearing of the phrase the great mystery has shown me that the ability of people to admit they don't know something compared to some of the religiosity which tends to have the script already laid out as if they know everything. And then I wonder about the whole, the way that he described Jung, saying that perhaps the sort of religious, the symbols of Wotan had that in people's dreams and psyches had sort of foreshadowed the Nazi the Nazi psychology among the Germans, that this whole religious concept of the punishment and the sacrifice, as he mentions birds and animals, that perhaps some of the what is manifesting today as the whether it's from the climate change or oil spills that affect the waterfowl, etc., that perhaps the sort of the concept or the religious belief, self-fulfilling prophecy type of thing, brings about these things. And so it makes it essential to relook at what one's beliefs and religious views, and to see, sort of beyond all that, just to check within one's own views and see how much that is it contributing to the world in a negative or positive way. And some of the sections in here that quote funny is just hearing Native comment on some of the whole mega church thing and the fundamentalist type thing, and hearing their comments is rather amusing. And here he continues. The forms of communication directed toward the deity or higher powers tell us a great deal about our emotional response to the image of God. Hymns, psalms, and chants of the Near Eastern religions are something to behold. They are, quite frankly, little more than crude attempts to flatter and deceive deities who possess preposterous egos. Omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, omnivorous, almost every human attribute we can conceive is expanded beyond its capability to communicate meaning and credited to the deities. We create logical inconsistencies when we try to apply the knowledge of our theology. Thus, if God is omnipotent, can he make a yardstick with one end? Christian hymns resemble nothing less than LBJ's or Nixon's White House assistants trying to convince the president of the propriety of their cause by puffing up his already considerable ego. At times, with the modern popularization of Christian ideas by televangelists, it is difficult to remember that Cole Porter's "You Are the Cream in My Coffee" is not a hymn. Indian songs and chants, on the other hand, frequently do not even mention a deity or the great mystery at all. They are directed to plants, birds, animals, and the earth, asking for assistance in performing rather mundane tasks. When they do specifically address the great mysterious power, their pleas are phrased in vague terms, primarily pleading that pity be shown to them. But these pleas do not flatter. They are more in the nature of an objective admission of the fact of human finitude, a rather obvious observation. So, interesting distinction there with the sort of the word God, and then all the levels, the more specifics, quote, below that he's talking about. And it also reminded me of I'd read Robert Haas talk about his theory. He says it's not a well-researched theory, but I think it has a lot of validity, that haiku were originally not just a report of nature, but actually more like a shamanic, an invocation to nature to help, say, bring about the cherry blossoms or bring about this or that. So we have here a similar interaction with nature, and that some prayer or chant is actually to the birds or to the plants, because the plants are going to feed you. So, talk to the plants, not necessarily to some just, unknowing, unknowable theoretical image of God. Oftentimes I find similarities with the native ways and the Kabbalah. Here's a paragraph. The Indian format is precise. He's talking about the salvation thing. The Indian format is precisely the opposite. Not only the natural physical world is regarded as integral to human ambitions and activities, but also even the hypothetical geometrical structures of the world, which receive some form of religious acknowledgement. Thus, Indians pray to the four directions, lay out elaborate sand paintings to represent the cosmos, and see in pipe bowls and sweat lodges a model of the larger cosmic whole. In contrast to the practices of the Near Eastern peoples, Indians virtually eliminate the human element in their religious ceremonies and concentrate on representing the physical universe. Reminded of, I think it was Da Vinci's, the picture of, man, the arms stretched out in the geometric shapes, and how, as far as the tree of life, how we're all little trees bearing our fruits, and how, the trees out there are, each has its function. doctrines of the world, religions expressed in the most precise phrases and elaborate concepts with every nuance of meaning represented by weighty tomes describe virtually nothing and do not inspire anyone to do much of anything. Much as I admire the philosophical writings of Paul Tillich, the social concerns of Reinhold Niebuhr, and the sense of modernity of Harvey Cox, their theologies do not trigger off great religious feelings in me. Indeed, I suspect that the ability to describe the attributes of God may preclude the possibility of ever experiencing him, her, or them. Academic orthodoxy in religious studies, however, regards the statements of the world religions as a higher evolved expression of religion, primarily because the concepts are more rational. Tribal religions, with their emotional and ceremonial emphasis, are placed at the bottom of the cultural evolutionary scale because they practice rather than preach. So again, showing this sort of great divide of Western, the Euro-Western thought, compared to the native Western. And again, referring to Zechariah Sechen here, some of Sechen's ideas beg credibility. The preliminary cosmology describing the creation of Earth is difficult to believe, and the mechanics of the Great Flood seem unlikely. So the narrative cannot be read critically. When it comes to explaining the origin of civilization and religious institutions, however, this thesis has a lot to offer. It provides a context in which virgin birth, blood offerings, the jealousies of gods, the erection of temples, and resulting institution of a priesthood, and the description of heaven as a courtroom, royal and jurisprudential, ring true. Most important, Orthodox scholars had come amazingly close to researching the same conclusions. Samuel Noah Kramer, the dean of Sumerian studies and archaeology, in his book History Begins at Sumer, seemed to endorse the idea that the astronauts engaged in some kind of genetic engineering in order to create lesser creatures who could work for them. Kramer observed that Sumerian thinkers, in line with their worldview, had no exaggerated confidence in man and his destiny. They were firmly convinced that man was fashioned of clay and created for one purpose, to serve the gods by supplying them with food, drink, and shelter so they might have full leisure for their divine activities. So, yeah, that's a quote from a book, and that shows a lot of the world stage today. If you replace gods with elitists or the supremacists or the corporations, to serve the gods by supplying them with food, drink, and shelter so they might have full leisure for their divine activities. Now, he also refers to these sort of genetic experiments and such in mentioning South Africa. So another perhaps spin on that is that perhaps Africa, as the mother of us all, was more of the this genetic experimenting possibility. This is reminding of the last show, talking about the floods and how perhaps the whole Near East religion start off on, you know, page 3, so to speak. He mentioned the third world of the Hopi. So here again, perhaps the whole thing about everyone coming from Africa, which seems to contradict natives coming from where they are, again, it's the framework of where that is posited. I'll read that one paragraph. Near Eastern religions seem to have originated as cults, with the additional element that our species was created specifically to work for outer space visitors. It would be impossible today to trace back into our various human societies and groups to locate the genes of the astronauts that went into creating us. But modern geneticists have posited the existence of a single woman who lived in southern Africa, precisely where Sitchin says the original genetic experiments were conducted, as probably the genetic mother of us all. So perhaps we are closer to verifying Sitchin's thesis than we would suppose. I suspect that tribal peoples would be only peripherally affected by these ancient astronaut intrusions. Most tribal peoples have no social forms or beliefs that would suggest they were part of the civilized complex that we find in the Near East civilizations. Many of them do have legends about people from the skies visiting them, intermarrying them. It goes on and on there. So another interesting distinction between where do you, perhaps there are these parallel tracks of world history, of the sort of astronaut beings coming to the Earth at some level, and then you have people that did not experience that. So big questions. In the next chapter, Death and Religion, here I have a a note saying sort of the schizoid pathology of religion as he charts it. Traditional Roman Catholic doctrine built into the idea of confession the possibility of canceling past sins through forgiveness by receiving the sacrament, and hence one could live a scandalous life and still reach heaven intact by reserving baptism until one's deathbed or in receiving the last rites, which wiped away all previous sins and prepared one to depart directly for heaven as the body stopped functioning. The Spanish, in slaughtering Indians, would have a priest standing by with holy water available as they disemboweled pregnant Indian women. If the fetus exposed momentarily to the outside world breathed or showed signs of life, the priest could baptize it before the soldiers smashed its head against the wall, thereby giving it an immediate audience with the Lord. Priests used to accommodate the Iroquois war parties who ravaged the Huron villages in Canada in the 1600s and baptize Hurons who were in their death throes. Therefore, baptism has been understood by Christians as a mechanical entrance into the next life. So aside from the horrificness of that, it gives a justification, say, for atrocities. When the culture or the religion has a reasoning, it gives a justification for these atrocities. And again, he talks about religion as controlling measures for manipulating large populations and not a realistic appraisal of cosmic reality. In the last analysis, personal responsibility became a responsibility to the set of behaviors that would guarantee eternal life, and not an ethic that would enable people to deal justly with their contemporaries. One cannot emphasize too carefully this aspect of Western religious tradition, for it was in the overemphasis on eternal life that people became separated from participation in the life cycles of the natural world, and death became something to be feared. One cannot emphasize too carefully this aspect of Western religious tradition, for it was in the overemphasis on eternal life that people became separated from participation in the life cycles of the natural world, and death became something to be feared. Again, the natives, you know, see the cycles and are more connected, and so don't see death even as a word. It's the energy goes on and on. So another level of the distinction between these ways. Many of the genocidal acts the Westerners committed against the Indians can be laid directly on the doorsteps of religious fanatics who saw conversion and death as the only viable solution to the Indian problem. Near Eastern religions had centuries of practice before and after Europeans came into contact with the American Indians. Oh, this is a quote from Chief Seattle, particularly relevant to what's going on now with the protests of stopping Shell in the Pacific. But he ends up with this, there is no death, only a change of worlds. That's more of the native and other ways of other peoples who align with that ways of seeing the world that way. And emphasizing that part here later on, Deloria says, immortality is secondary to integrity of tribal existence in the present, and we find not a cringing fear of death but a religious community so strong as to virtually shrug off death as an enemy. So as mentioned earlier in the book, one's identity, even if you have a community identity, then you know it shifts your own relationship with life death type of things, because it is the well-being of the community that takes precedence, not your individual existence. Not to diminish that, but it's a different framework from the hyper individualized preservation type of society that we still experience in various guises. Towards the end of the book, certainly looking forward to conveying what he talks there about the rites, about the native ceremonies. And here he says, some tribes had special ceremonies to be used in conjunction with the dead. The Lakota or Sioux, for example, had a ceremony in which the sacred pipe was used and the souls of the recently departed were kept with the tribal community to be purified and eventually released. In a tragic interference with the tribal religion, the government banned this ceremony in the 1890s, causing a great trauma among the people. So yeah, that's the whole post-traumatic stress disorder, that to catch up with what's going on now with Native peoples, is to realize that they had, you know, their many of their ceremonies for many years were banned, and the disconnect that they experienced due to that. And here again, ending this chapter, Deloria just, you know, sort of highlights the common sense approach to dealing with stuff. While death is truly a saddening event for people of tribal religious traditions, it is an event with which every person and nation is faced, and not an arbitrary, capricious exercise of divine wrath. Even today, this attitude persists in Indian societies, and the natural grief occurring with the loss of a loved one is rarely translated into personal feelings of guilt, inadequacy, or sin, which appear to plague Westerners. The community regroups and continues to exist. While individuals are lonely, they are not alone. And chapter 11, human personality. Here he talks about what can actually be changed, and the ability of the Christian religion to change people's hearts and mind has been a gigantic hoax perpetrated for an unknown purpose by unknown people. What actually changes? Western people have become accustomed to thinking of religious activity as involving a radical change of human personality. The Indian tribal religions do not necessarily involve any significant change in human personality, but encompass within the tribal cultural context many of the behavioral patterns spoken about by Christians. Just thinking of the vision quest and that, you know, as a ritual that does bring about a change, but it seems like that's more in line with the who one already is, sort of discovering who one already is rather than this whole sin-based change thing. And some of this here ties in with a lot of what's going on nowadays. Today we are suffering the impact of 2,000 years of Christian individualism. Social problems continue to mount with no apparent solution in sight, yet the U.S. appears to have a substantial number of devout Christians inhabiting it. We conducted a long war in Asia that was prolonged primarily for political reasons by two presidents, yet both of these men were apparently Christians in good standing. Prominent church leaders such as Dr. Billy Graham did not call them to account as being anti-Christian or non-Christians for the wastage of human life. In the Gulf War, some church leaders did make an effort to prevent bloodshed, but their religious objections proved irrelevant to George Bush. The rising rate of mental illness, especially the alarming rise in multiple murders and police brutality and civil disorders, would indicate that there is something amiss. The continued proliferation of psychologists, psychoanalysts, group therapy, psychodramas, and other phenomena indicative of attempts to heal the spiritual problems of modern people should tell us that at least part of our conception of the nature of religion has been mistaken. If Christianity saves the individual, and the evidence that it does appears to be decreasing, it must certainly be determined a failure when societies or even large numbers of human beings are concerned. And without the ability to invoke emotion, create fear and anxiety, and promise instantaneous relief from such fear, the evangelists are helpless. It is by artificially creating that solitary individual through deliberate manipulation of his or her emotions that they give credence to their version of the Christian religion. Theologians are notably absent in the solutions of social problems, in the ongoing work of local communities, and the examination of the nature of human personality and its problems. That reminded me of the mainstream media, where, you know, again, it's the whole televangelist phenomenon. A lot of the mainstream media is a sort of facet of televangelism. Here again is an insight into the native ways. Theology is part of communal experiences needing no elaboration, abstraction, or articulation of principles. Every factor of human experience is seen in a religious light as part of the meaning of life. Tribal customs structuring relationships found to be proper for people are continued. Preconceived standards of conduct are unimportant, and the assumption of the innate sinfulness of human is impossible, for the individual is judged instantaneously by his or her fellows as useful or useless according to his or her degree of participation in community affairs. So it's, you know, it's more a matter of function and activity and what one does rather than, in that sense of, I think he's saying, the participation. You know, if you're going to do something, then you're part of the community. If you're not, then you're not. And he highlights the name. Every person has a name given in religious ceremonies in which his uniqueness is recognized. The individual doggedly and determinedly fasts and sings sacred songs with the hope that he or she will be granted a religious vocation to serve the people. No ranting and raving preacher threatens everlasting hellfire and damnation unless an immediate decision is forthcoming. Yeah, they have it as rather than it coming from the outside, like an outside threat, the religio spirituality comes from within the culture as already, constructed and guided. It mentions the Iroquois and Cherokee with the sophisticated systems for dream interpretation. So that's, one of the biggest things here when he's talking about the human personality, the human individual in context of with the community compared to the solitary individuals and that whole solitariness that is part of a modern society. Something like 25% of the US people are on medication for depression or whatever. This whole isolations and all the side effects that come from that, the alcoholism and addictions. And again, this has to be put at least looked at in the context of the religious programming to see and the cultural programming and compared with this communal way to see if there are other solutions rather than just solutions within the system. And again, Deloria lays it on the line. One can only conclude that while Christianity can describe what is considered as a perfect human behavior, it cannot produce such behavior. So he's talking about the proof is in the pudding. Perhaps the closest approach that any Christian community has made to the type of behavior described by countless observers of Indian religion is that of the Amish communities of the Midwest. By every criteria that measures social integrity, the Amish appear to rank far above the communities and other denominations of Christianity. Hardly a Christian denomination can approach the record of the Amish for lack of delinquency, lack of idleness, lack of alcoholism, lack of divorce, lack of any statistic that would indicate social disintegration. Need it be noted that the Amish have settled on and related to definite lands that they hold themselves in a tight communal setting, and that they adhere to customs with the tenacity of belief that amazes outsiders and brings them to as many clashes with civil authority as any group in the nation. That the Amish can make their religion work indicates not so much the validity of their religion, but that they have created a specific community that relates land, community, and religion into one integrated whole. To a lesser degree, the Mormons have also accomplished this task. The proper response of human personality to religious experience would seem to involve the factors that Indian tribal religions have traditionally emphasized, which the Amish and Mormons at least partially emphasize or practice, and that has distinguished American Indian people from the rest of America. In a sense, then, religion must relate to land, and it must dominate and structure culture. It must not be separated from a particular piece of land and a particular community, and it must not be determined by culture. So there you have it, up through chapter 11, the different types of personalities, the whole manipulation of the genetic manipulation now that we have of artificial insemination and all these kind of cultural offshoots, to go back to this sort of what is the origin point, I think affects the whole how one perceives this. So again, going back to whatever supposed origin of a religion, or as Deloria described, the sort of not the specific origin place, but the way of the culture, and seeing the human as integrated and connected with the community and with the land, and seeing their religion or spirituality as part of all that is a key thing to helping to live, to not only to live sanely, but also to help the world to work better, or to work as it is naturally meant to work, as it does work, but that we start to think it doesn't work from all these side effects. So, more to come in the next parts. Thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a short song from looking on YouTube here, an Amish song, Amish. Springtime is coming. And interesting, some of the lyrics talk about the birds are singing and the lilies are coming and God is caring for them. And so I would interpret that as connecting with some of what was described in the show about this invocation for the actualities of what is going on.
Free or go hair, free or go hair, free. Be there, be there, be there.